Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
In today's show, we spoke to Dr. Chris Bearer, a professor of medicine at Duke University, the director of the Duke Global Health Institute, and an internationally recognized epidemiologist who's worked on the front lines of the HIV/AIDS and COVID-19 pandemics. We discussed the need to integrate public health and human rights, how to navigate the tension between international collaborations and parachute science, and his work advocating for some of the most vulnerable people across the world. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about global health or just intrigued about how doctors can have international impacts. So without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Dr. Bearer. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with us. So we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into medicine?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question for me. I mean, I had early on thought I might go have a career in veterinary medicine or maybe in science. And I did the prerequisites for pre-med as an undergrad at Hobart College. And then I really got more interested in the social sciences, in anthropology, and in history. I ended up majoring in history. And I spent a good part of my senior year abroad in Sri Lanka. And Sri Lanka was really where it was the first time I'd lived overseas, my first time in an Asian country. I really, you know, felt this was so profoundly interesting. It was inspiring. And that somehow or other, I had to have a career. I had to do work that kept this cross-cultural international component going. Then I finished college and I basically started, you know, on a period of travel and spending time in Asia, in India, Nepal, in Ladakh, and really following more of a Buddhist path. And I thought I was going to be a writer, and you know, I was having really the time of my life. But eventually I ended up volunteering in this Tibetan refugee camp. And I just felt increasingly that what I was studying was so interesting to me. And I was really, really finding it deeply motivating. But I really wasn't helping anybody else. And I was kind of an expensive mouth to feed compared to some of the other people who was there. And I actually was in a very remote part of the Himalayas. I was doing a Buddhist retreat. And I met a young German doctor who was working. He had actually a pack of donkeys and yaks, and he was doing childhood immunization in these remote villages. And I just thought to myself, all right, who am I kidding? I definitely have to have a career in this field. And I went back to the States, not directly, took some more time. But eventually I did, and I got into medical school, started medical school in New York City, in Brooklyn, at State University of New York, downstate, which is in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. And I basically walked into the AIDS pandemic unfolding on New York City.
I mean, what a wonderful way to start. I relate with a lot of what you're saying as someone who's studying history of science in college, as a writer myself. But I want to ask you a little bit more about sort of what it must have been like to be in New York City at that time, right, in the middle of the AIDS pandemic, especially because that's something that you spend a lot of your career focused on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think for certainly for many people of my cohort, it felt like there was absolutely no choice. I mean, you know, you have this enormous epidemic. New York City was one of the global epicenters, and it's a new disease, and it's not treatable. And at the time, I mean, actually, when I started, we didn't even really have a test. I mean, HIV/AIDS was a clinical syndrome. But in addition to that, I'm a gay man. And, I had a partner who was an actor, went to Juilliard, was an absolutely wonderful guy. And, you know, we were also gay men living through that period in New York. And he got more and more involved in activism, and then eventually, you know, it was clear that he was living with HIV, and So it's just, you know, like absolutely at the center of our world. And he died of an AIDS-related malignancy just as I was finishing my residency training. And I had, you know, been working in HIV. I did my clinical training at Hopkins. I did a preventive medicine residency, public health. And I really, in that process, got more and more engaged in prevention and in vaccines. And it really seemed at the time that and we weren't going to get out of this pandemic without a vaccine. I still believe that, by the way. It's just been, you know, 35 years of failed trials, but it's not for want of trying. And so when I finished my training, I really wasn't sure what I was going to do next. I had a bunch of different offers, and it turned out that Hopkins had just gotten one of the very first grants to set up HIV vaccine infrastructure and start doing all the research you need to do. Molecular epidemiology, virology, and in northern Thailand, which I'd never been. I'd never been to Southeast Asia, but this was 1992, still a long way off from antiviral therapy, which wouldn't come until 96. And so I signed up, and that was my first job, and I moved out to Thailand with two bags, and I stayed there for 5 years, and it was just extraordinary. Mm-hmm.
No, certainly, and I think that's something that I'm really struck by your career just in general, that you spent your life really advocating for some of the most vulnerable communities in the world. Like particularly, for example, you're advocating for the Rohingya refugees in Myanmar who've suffered mass persecution, violence, and displacement. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about sort of this work at the interface of public health and human rights. I think it's something that we're increasingly seeing, like, what role should physicians, should global health advocates have sort of in that advocacy space, right? A lot of physicians don't want to be advocates, or they feel uncomfortable with that aspect of the job.
I'll tell you, the what happened for me, the kind of dawning of this was that I was living and working in Thailand, as I said, which at the time had an emerging democratic government, but maybe more importantly, had quite a strong public health infrastructure. And I'd never been in a place where once you had a scientific finding, you take it to the government and they change the policy. So I was working, we were doing preventive interventions with the Thai soldiers, with the Royal Thai Army. And, you know, we discovered, for example, that that most of the guys were getting infected from basically commercial sex from sex workers. And so, you know, I said to the Surgeon General of Thailand, you know, guy in a full military regalia, we're going to have to, you know, really work on safer sex, condom promotion, STI treatment. You know, these guys are really getting infected in these commercial settings. And we're going to have to work with the sex industry and really try and you know, make that safer. And he just looked at me, you know, and I was waiting for like, how dare you? And you can't say that about my country. And he said, oh, this is good. Good. Absolutely. We're going to do this. Just remember, they're young Thai men. So you have to maintain sexual pleasure. Okay. It's not New York. You know, it is Thailand. It's a different place. But right around us were countries like Laos that had a very terribly underdeveloped healthcare system and were just not, and very authoritarian state. And they were not really able to respond. And Burma at the time in the 90s was under intense military rule. There had been an uprising. Aung San Suu Kyi had, you know, come to power, won the elections, but then was jailed. And they were totally unable to respond. So I understood more and I started thinking more and writing more about social determinants of health, the political determinants of health, and also, unfortunately, at the time, so it was an earlier period of Burma's conflict, but there was a civil war underway, and it was very much targeting ethnic minorities. And so I started doing more and more work in those conflict zones and working with a number of different ethnic groups, the Karen, the Shan, and also going to, you know, the other sides of the border. So going to Northeast India, to Manipur, where I was, you know, arrested. But as a tip, perhaps another story. And eventually, I felt, you know, that really was sort of coming at this from two sides. On the one hand, medicine, physicians, as you said, public health was really insufficiently, I felt, paying attention to these human rights dimensions, the social justice dimensions. And on the other hand, when you looked at the human rights world, it basically was lawyers and journalists. And, you know, they don't use population-based methods. They don't know how to do that. And I'm a trained epidemiologist. You know, that's what I was doing, medical epidemiology. So I felt that we really needed to bring the tools of science, of modern population-based science, to human rights investigations. And so we really started doing that in Burma and in a number of other places. And in Russia, by the way, where I also worked for a number of years, in China, India. And eventually, I created the Center for Public Health and Human Rights at Johns Hopkins to really bring those elements together. We developed courses around this. We have a certificate program in health and human rights. We're right near the hospital emergency entrance. And also then did a textbook in this area, Public Health and Human Rights Evidence-Based Approaches, which was really an attempt to try and make this happen. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, unfortunately, that right now we're in a more of a, there's a great deal of course, conflict, displacement. There's anti-immigrant sentiment in many countries. We are seeing rising persecution of sexual and gender minority folks. I just had to write my entire faculty and staff here at the Institute when Uganda passed this draconian anti-gay law to say, first of all, we now really have to pay attention to students and staff and others who may go and visit Uganda. The people need to know that it's not safe for LGBTQ people to be there. And in addition to that, I said, I understand that other faculty may continue to work there, and I'm sure that they will. But I, as a gay man, am not setting foot in that country until that law is repealed. And I think, you know, to get back all the way back, Simmer, to your sort of opening question on this point is that, yes, I think, unfortunately, medicine has been very cautious about engaging on these issues. And that is really a luxury we cannot afford, particularly as we see these interactions of social justice and the climate. Because, you know, the people who have done almost nothing to cause the climate crisis are paying the highest price, like the Rohingya. And in contrast, of course, you know, those of us of means in countries of means can make a go of it with air conditioning and technology. It's a terrible irony.
Yeah. You know, there's been a lot of discourse in the global health literature over parachute science, right? This idea that researchers dropping in from the ivory tower to conduct studies in low and middle income settings. I mean, you've obviously engaged with a lot of international research collaborations on Thailand, Russia, Malawi, Kazakhstan, elsewhere, and you've been very sensitive to this. So I wanted to ask sort of how you think about this idea of parachute science, how big an issue you see it is, and sort of what should people be doing better to, respect these collaborators and not sort of almost steal their work and parachute in without sort of that proper understanding.
Yeah. Well, it's very important. I think our field right now overall is going through a period of real introspection about this. This language you've, I'm sure, very familiar with, of decolonizing global health, thinking about how we do this. To me, you know, having been involved in this work now for more than three decades, I have to say that I think the science and medicine, healthcare, really is an international collaborative undertaking. And, honestly, we don't have a choice. We just lived through the COVID pandemic and saw, you know, so abundantly clearly how interconnected we all are. The reality is, you know, that there have never been more people, right? Because we have the largest human population in the world. We have the largest adolescent cohort in human history. And they are the most interconnected that they've ever been. I think these relationships are going to change, and they need to change, and the structures need to change. But the reality is, there's a lot of pressure against international collaboration, and we have to push back. That is absolutely, and it's a false narrative, I have to tell you. I mean, and I have seen also over the years that nothing has a bigger impact on public health practice and policy than well-done randomized controlled trials. What changes the world is a well-done randomized controlled trial. And they're always collaborative. And they take big teams of people and they take big money. And if you, you know, take a beady-eyed look, really, at who is funding this, nobody's ever funded it to the same degree that the U.S. has. We're the largest funder of biomedical research by far. I mean, we have $3 billion a year just in HIV research dollars alone every year. And, you know, the Brits and the French are kind of second to us. And, you know, they're kind of like in the several hundred million, 40 million range. I mean, there is no comparison. And that is the generosity of the American people. It's also that we have made this commitment. We've advanced science. I mean, I cannot tell you how much better it is and how much more we know than when I was a medical student. It's just unbelievable. You know, I mean, life expectancy with HIV when I started was 11 months. It's now 72 years. And it took 800 clinical trials to get to triple therapy. But we do really have to examine those relationships. And, you know, they if they're going to be sustained and be meaningful and last, they really have to be built over many years. And it's like anything else. It's right. The human relationships.
Right.
The human relationships are what make it.
No, certainly. I think that's something about health and scientific inquiry. They're universal languages of sorts, that we all experience these moments of getting sick and becoming ill. And that's something that we all connect with in to a certain capacity. So no, I think that's really helpful in terms of the importance of these international collaborations. I think it's something that also a lot of students are thinking about or not thinking about, frankly speaking. I feel like many emerging medical students or doctors are very content to focus in on their very narrow part of the world. And I guess, I mean, there's not necessarily anything that's wrong with that. People have their interests, they have the, sort of what they care about. But I'm curious why you think students should care more about global health, should care more about these sort of infectious diseases across the world.
Well, it's interesting. When I was making my decision about where to, you know, where to, what field to go into, and I was like an AOA honor student, you know, all those things. I had thought I was going to go into family medicine, and I put that forward. And I had I never got a letter from the dean. I got a letter from the dean. You must come and see me immediately. And he said, somebody like you, you've got really good grades, you're honor society. Why would you go into anything like family medicine? You might as well be a nurse. I mean, you should be going into a subspecialty, you know? And that was totally the focus of where medicine was and training was. And we have gone very far down that path by, you know, specializing and super specializing. But unfortunately, we have failed to create a just, equitable healthcare system. And we have seen again and again, COVID is another great example, that our failure to actually have a functioning primary healthcare system and a functioning public health system that covers all 50 states and territories continues to hinder us, right, from responding. And, you know, I worked on the COVID vaccine trials when we were really in the thick of trying to figure it out with vaccination and pre-existing immunity and COVID care and, you know, who was dying and who wasn't dying. We had to rely, we relied on the UK, on Israel, and on South Africa because they had national data. And we have chaos, you know, chaos. Different reporting, different states, you know, the Kaiser Permanente not reporting to the state of California, nobody reporting to the Fed. I mean, it's just, you know, breathtaking. So there's a reality that we have to face, which is that, you know, what we really need to do to advance health equity is be sure that everybody has the basics. We have not done that. You do need specialty care and you do need advanced care, of course. We also are going to have to, in many, many countries, have much wider, lower trained cadres of healthcare workers who are trained enough to provide the basics and also refer up when it's obvious that somebody needs more help. So I'll give you an example that we're launching. We've just launched a new program in global mental health. And one of the things that COVID, so underscored is that we're in a global mental health crisis, and it's particularly severe for young people and adolescents. So the age group that you mentioned of people who are your listeners, there is a huge amount of mental health challenges there. And you know, they can be life-threatening. We have had about a 15% increase in anorexia nervosa. Well, anorexia has about a 14% mortality, you know? I mean, it's a serious disease. So just to say, when we looked at the landscape, we wanted to do this with adolescent medicine. Across the entire continent of Africa, there are 75 child psychiatrists. So that's as many as in the city of Stockholm, right? And 50 of those 75 are in South Africa. So for the rest of the continent, it's never going to be, or not for a very long time, that people will be able to see a psychiatrist. So how are we going to deal with this global mental health problem? Well, first of all, you have to look to nursing. It's the largest, you know, part of the healthcare workforce. You have to look to educating community health workers, much lower level health workers, in the basics. How do you recognize suicide, suicidality in an adolescent? How do you start the conversations about anorexia? You know, getting these folks out. And that is going to be the model, I think, for many, many diseases. And of course, we're going to be able to use technology to leap over a lot of these challenges. So, you know, many of the countries where I work, they never did landlines. They never bothered, because by the time they were ready to start really having, you know, wide phone access, the cell phone was, you know, had been invented. And so we just went with towers and, you know, and they have been transformative for the lives of the poor, right? So there's, you know, way more we can be doing with telemedicine, with phone-based, you know, simple approaches. And by the way, creating these referral pyramids to get really sick people into care who need it. So, you know, it's an exciting time, but it's also, I think, taught us again what an expensive and what a profoundly dysfunctional health system we have, or systems.
I think that's really helpful. And, you know, there's a saying in hockey that you shouldn't go where the puck is, you should go where the puck is going to be, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I'm sort of curious about is that it seems that some of the most pressing problems in global health today are sort of this idea of how do you build that sort of healthcare system? How do you build those cadres of healthcare workers who can, for example, take care of mental health? I'm curious where you think the field, the global health field, is going to be in the next 20 years. And I imagine that, for your answer, it'll be something to do with technology.
Well, I'll tell you, unfortunately, most people probably would tell you, and I think it's correct, that the biggest sort of tranche of new funding and new resources that we're going to see is going to be in pandemic preparedness. And we've had a history of pandemic preparedness funding after pandemics that largely didn't achieve very much, was often somewhat wasted. And the cycle is described as the cycle of panic, overfunding, and then neglect. So we would like to avoid that. I don't know if we're going to be able to. I do think that there are many, many countries, particularly middle-income countries, have come away from what has happened in the last number of years, realizing that they have to get out of this client relationship with the West. I mean, you know, the COVID vaccine delivery just did not happen. So for example, I was in Rwanda 2 weeks ago, and they just signed an agreement with BioNTech, the Pfizer partners, and they want to develop capacity to make mRNA vaccines in Rwanda. The big scramble right now in the biotech sector is between India and China, you know, in a huge way. And India has figured out a way to make money on generic drugs that nobody else can seem to do effectively. And, you know, they make all the amoxicillin that's marketed in the world. You know, it's a generic drug. If it was left to the U.S. market, we would lose amoxicillin. Children would suffer middle ear infections interminably because Americans can't make a profit at it. And so, you know, that part of the world is really changing, and I think it's going to change fast. But it is also the result of really important investments. So I'll give you one example there, which is that, South Africa ended up being such an essential partner for us on COVID. We did a number of trials together there. It was extraordinary collaboration. But all of that infrastructure was built for HIV in partnership between the U.S. and South Africa for PEPFAR and for the HIV vaccine trials. And, you know, we have leveraged the investments we've made in HIV for so many other things in global health. And by the way, the HIV epidemic is not over either. So people are declaring victory much too soon, in my opinion. That is still, it's amazing. I've been at this for 41 years. And we still don't have a vaccine.
Yeah. No, I think that's all fascinating. And I know that you've tried to do this work from multiple different angles. Most recently, you are now the director of the Duke Global Health Institute. So I want to ask for listeners who may not be familiar, could you speak a little bit about the Institute and why you decided to move from Johns Hopkins to lead it?
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting situation. Duke, of course, is a wonderful university. It has a great undergrad program. It has a great medical school, nursing school. It does not have a school of public health. So, and that's to some extent because University of North Carolina, just down the road, is a state school and has a very good school of public health. So there's never been a compelling need in the same way. So what that has meant is that most of the people who are working in international health, global health, and public health are sort of under this global health umbrella. And it's a very interesting, it was created in a rather unique way that it is both for, I report both to the dean of the medical school and the provost of the university. So it is truly interdisciplinary. And Duke is an interesting place because it's a very intentional place. You know, it's smaller than Hopkins, but it really has a mission. Like there's a vice provost for interdisciplinary education who I meet with regularly and wants to know how my interdisciplinarity is going. There was never anything like that at Hopkins. You know, Hopkins, you are supposed to write grants, write important papers, get famous, get funded, and good luck to you, you know. But this is a very different place. And I was, I think, just personally also ready for a career change. When I was sort of coming up through the ranks, the people who were ahead of me did not get out of the way. And I had to really, you know, elbow my way into the academic leadership. And I didn't want to be that person. And I felt like my team, my center, Public Health and Human Rights, was ripe, and there was a great group of people. They were moving on to, you know, associate and full professor, and it was time for me to let other people lead. So that mattered. But it is wonderful to be here. I have to say that I've been really impressed at how committed to this fundamental mission of global health equity that people here are. It's really impressive. They're not making it up.
No, I remember in high school, I was visiting family in India, and I spent time at the Duke Clinical Research Institute, right? Uh-huh. In Medanta at Gurgaon. From a very early age, I've been witness to Duke's sort of commitment to global health. You know, I think that nearly wraps up the episode. Before we go, I wanted to ask for your three pieces of advice for students interested in careers in global health.
Well, the first thing I would say is you do want to get some real expertise. So you need to get training, whatever that is. It can be very diverse. I mean, there are wonderful careers in nursing, in global health, obviously, in medicine, and just straight public health. But that really is important. You have to have the intention. You have to have the commitment. But you want to have expertise to bring to the table. And there's no question that for the next generation, that expertise is also increasingly quantitative. It really is going to matter. And if you're in this field, people expect you to be sophisticated about those aspects. I think the second thing that really matters is, getting out, getting into the field, volunteering. This is still not that big a field, and it's amazing how many people I know have the jobs that they have because of internships, because of rotations, because of, you're in a place and it feels consistent with who you are, and you connect with the people and they connect with you. And, before you know it, you're being asked back and going again. So that's, I think, a very important aspect. And finally, I would say that it's critically important to check your own motivation. Think about your own motivation, because I'm a Buddhist for many decades. In Buddhism, we say acts themselves are rather neutral. It's motivations which make them either likely to succeed or likely to cause more harm. And it's important to do that too, because it's easy to end up working, as a lot of my friends and colleagues have, in big pharma, in the corporate side of this. The corporate sector is much larger than the academic sector. I mean, the people who do what I do and like teach academic global health, we are a tiny proportion of the field. And so you really do need to maintain that motivation. And my sort of truth of my whole career has always been that the way to do that is not be stuck in an office. You've got to get out into the field. The field is where it all happens. That's where the best questions come from. They're usually asked by somebody very junior in a very tough situation who says things like, "Why is it so difficult to do this?" That's a good question. All right.
No, I mean, what a note to end on. It reminds me of a quote that those closest to the struggle know what the issues are, but it's also the people who are seeing it from a new lens sometimes. So thank you so much, Dr. Bayer, for coming on the show. Really appreciate it.
I really enjoyed this. Yeah. It's really nice to speak with you and nice to meet you, Simmer. And I'm glad you're doing this. I think it's really a service. It's important.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.